Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, the programme that brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. You're welcome to contact the programme via Twitter at InsideEd, through email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you have an education story or event that you'd like to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. This week I bring you an in-depth interview with Pamela Munn, Professor Emeritus at the University of Edinburgh. Pamela Munn was in Ireland last month to give the latest lecture in the Education Lecture Public Policy Series, which is organised by the Vere Foster Trust. The trust is named after the founder of the Irish National Teachers' Organisation. Pamela Munn is a noted researcher whose main interests are in behaviour management in schools, curriculum policy and values education. She was awarded an OBE for services to education in Scotland in 2005. She's one of three authors of the influential Salberg Report on the Structure of Initial Teacher Education in Ireland. Pamela Munn's talk, which took place at the National Gallery of Ireland, was titled Taking Research-Informed Teaching Seriously, From Aspiration to Reality. When I spoke to her before the lecture, I noted that Pamela had begun her career in education as a history teacher, and I asked her to tell me about that work.
I taught in two different schools in London, one in Essex, where all the pupils were the sons and daughters of Dagenham workers, who thought that studying history was not going to do them much good in their working lives. And I tried to encourage them to think differently about that. And then latterly, I worked in Walthamstow, in an outer London borough. And that was a really, really interesting school. It was an all-girls school, a state school, and it took girls from 14 to 18. And I taught everything from CSE, as it was then, to A-level and Oxbridge entrance. I ended up being head of sixth form there. I was very, very sorry to leave it, but we left to come back to Scotland.
And how did you motivate those students who didn't want to learn history to do so?
I think every teacher will try and do is get an angle that will interest children. So for bits, for example, I can remember, this is a long time ago now, I was having to teach aspects of British Constitution, which is not the most riveting of subjects. And so I started with people who were members of sports clubs and football clubs and say, how do we organise how these things are run? And who decides what the rules are and so on? And then I tried to move from that to broader issues about governance in the UK. One of the most challenging things I ever had to teach was the 1833 Bank Charter Act. It's still in here because it was so challenging to teach him, to try and encourage youngsters to make sense of. And I brought in money and showed them, you know, what does a promise to pay mean and all the rest of it. So what, in a nutshell, what you try and do is engage, find a hook that will get people interested and then let children run with that and develop questions that they want to find out the answers to. Children know, young people know, that things aren't the way they are by magic. And often getting children to think about their family tree, for instance, although that can be a delicate topic, but that's again a way into thinking about things. And I can remember having to teach the slave trade and thinking very carefully, teaching to a mixed ethnic group, what's the best way into this? And I wouldn't say it's easy to get people engaged, but if you start from the premise that there will be hooks that will engage people, that then takes you on. And being flexible about what you do, you know.
Looking back to your beginning teaching and with all the experience that you've gained in education since then, and if you were to talk to that young teacher of history in London, what would you say to her now?
I would say education is so important, schooling is so important to people's life chances, but more than that, it opens up such vast horizons of knowledge we have so many sources of information available to us now. People have so much information at their fingertips, but you have to learn to be discriminating about that information. What can you trust? What should you be sceptical about? And what should you just say, well, that's snake oil? Yeah.
So you were teaching history and then you became a teacher educator. How did that transition happen?
Well, what happened first was that I moved from Walthamstow back to Stirling, and I got a research post there at the University of Stirling, where we were looking at issues of accountability in education. And from there, I moved to the University of York, where I was working with a group of teacher educators, focusing very much on the continuous professional development of teachers, not so much at that time on initial teacher education. And we had a programme of collaborative action research. We recruited teams of teachers from the same school to work on common problems. And I stayed there for a number of years, and then I moved back to the Murray House School of Education, which at that time was associated with Heriot Watt University. And then, after a long and complicated story, finally merged with the University of Edinburgh.
If you go back to your CPD work, your continuing professional development, what kind of model did you use for working with teachers at the time?
Well, first of all, we wanted teachers to work together. So it was important that there were at least three or four would be better, teachers from the same school. We encouraged them to identify an issue that they were encountering in their classrooms or that they thought was an issue for the school, and then to develop skills of inquiry into how could we understand this problem, what sources of information were available, what assumptions were we making about this problem, and then encourage them to try to take some action on the basis of defining the problem and thinking through what would help make the problem go away or at least mitigate it in some way.
So it was very much teachers teaching each other?
Yes, under a framework, of different inputs from university staff. So that, for instance, if somebody wanted to do some interviews, then we would run a session on different kinds of interviewing. If somebody wanted to design a questionnaire, we would do that. If somebody wanted to research documents, again, we would do sessions on how you did that. And then we encouraged people to write up. Some went on to do dissertations and get master's degrees. Others felt that having done the work and getting to a qualification such as a diploma, say, that was all they wanted. They didn't want to really engage in major writing. And that is a well-known issue with teacher research, to encourage teachers to write up what they do and publish and be open to scrutiny, I think, is really important.
But isn't part of the problem there that there are very few outlets for teachers to publish in as opposed to researchers?
I think that's changing. I'm not saying that teachers should publish only in academic journals, but I do think, the classic definition of research is systematic inquiry made public. And you can be public in all kinds of ways. You can write for newspapers. You can do blogs. There are lots of new digital media now that you can publish. There are teacher journals. There are publishers who run a whole series of teacher research books, for example. So I think the picture is changing. And what we have to do is encourage people to be public about what they have found out. They don't all have to write books, but they need to be public in some way.
And isn't part of the problem with education that that research and teaching are just so divorced from one another in so many cases?
I think no, but then you'd say that, wouldn't you? I mean, there is a well-known sort of theory-practice divide, which I see as mythical, actually, going the rounds. Teacher education has always been based in practice. From initial teacher education, it's not that students spend 3 or 4 years in university and then suddenly meet a class for the first time. That's always been a mixture of what goes on in the university and what goes on in practice schools. The key question is how to make sure that these are integrated in a really nice, productive way. And we have lots of examples of what we say in our report that I'm going to be talking about tonight, research-informed clinical practice, where the university on the one side and practice schools on the other get together to plan a programme. So it's not the university telling schools what to do or schools telling universities what they must do, but it's a collaborative effort and trying to sequence the kinds of issues that beginning teachers will encounter inevitably, looking at that from a practical viewpoint, but also saying, well, how can research help me understand what I've just experienced?
So can you give an example then of what that might look like in practice, about how this dance between research and teaching looks like in practice?
Well, I mean, I'll give you a practical example for myself. As you know, I've done a lot of work on behaviour in schools, and every young teacher is worried about maintaining good behaviour. And young teachers often think only of themselves. They don't think actually about the interactions between themselves and the children they're teaching. So if you encounter a class that is unruly, or there are a few people there that are causing problems, first of all, you have to think about, well, how can I understand what happened there? Not just they didn't do what I wanted them to do. What was the context? What was I asking? What do I know about this pupil? What do I know about this class? What does research say about behaviour? What causes me? Now, you don't do that in the classroom, because, of course, your business there is to teach. You're not standing saying, well, what are the competing theories of behaviour? But the university then provides the context in which people bring these experiences, and mentor teachers are there to help flesh out the picture of what happened and to think about what kind of strategies might make the situation more positive next time round.
Okay, and that will work for teachers who have a connection to a university,
yes.
But the vast majority of teachers don't. So how do those teachers access the wealth of research that is available, or how do they contribute to it when a lot of it is published in journals that are so hard to access?
Well, that is a legitimate issue. In Scotland, in fact, the General Teaching Council for Scotland has just signed an agreement, so giving all teachers who are on the register access to, I think, 1,400 academic journals. So that's one way. Although when I've been talking to people about this, what I say is universities are full of people who know the literature. All right, there might be some teachers who want to go and find all these things out for themselves. Great. But what I'm wanting to encourage is a much greater partnership between researchers and teachers, so that if they have a problem, whether it's on behaviour, learning theory, primary, secondary transfer, or whatever it is, they have a way in to a university who can either, there's an expert there who can say, here's what we know about this so far, or who can point them in the right direction.
But those researchers who you said know the literature, and obviously they do, they don't write in a language that is accessible to teachers.
Well, they write, that's a bit hard. I mean, of course they have to write for different audiences. they have, in the UK, they have the cost of the research assessment exercise hanging over them, and they must write in a scholarly way for an academic audience. And that's where they get their work really robustly criticised, and that's what scholarship is all about. But increasingly there are briefings, short bits of writing. Some researchers now do blogs.
Okay. You one of your jobs over the years was to chair the Committee for Citizenship for
That's
Scotland.
Right.
What did that work involve?
Well, that was, again, a very, very interesting job. At that point, there was no citizenship curriculum, overtly anyway, in Scottish schools. So it involved, first of all, getting a range of people round a table to talk about what counted as citizenship, what schools were already doing, and what were the strengths and weaknesses of what was there. And then producing a series of discussion papers, consultation papers, which eventually evolved into guidance. So in other words, we didn't write a citizenship curriculum, but rather we said, if you are teaching citizenship, which we hope you will teach, here are the kinds of things that we hope you will do. And that was under the auspices of the Curriculum Council at that time. And then I think an important follow-up to that was in this age of accountability and performativity, I was asked to chair a group looking at how we would measure whether what was happening on the citizenship curriculum. And we tried to do that in a very... I was going to say soft way, but we didn't think that you could boil citizenship down to a few tick boxes. And what we tried to do was say, here are the kinds of things that if you're doing citizenship well, if you're an inspector, say, or you're a school leader, you might be looking out for. And one of these was about multidisciplinary activity, clear routes of progression, trying to encourage pupil participation in various aspects of school decision-making, and so on and so forth.
So, I mean, you say that citizenship can't be, you know, reduced to a few tick boxes, but can it even be taught?
Yes. I mean, there are certain things about... There's political literacy that, of course, can be taught. There's social citizenship that can be taught. But I know what you're saying. What's really important, and we tried to stress this in the report, was there was no point in saying things about participation and democracy and not living them in a school. And so it was very important that you had a school ethos that tried to reflect the values underpinning kind of democratic participatory citizenship.
And so the goal of the citizenship curriculum then is for this democratic participatory inclination to foster that in students, is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's a very nice way of summing it up. But there isn't a citizenship exam. You know, you can't get an A in citizenship or a B in citizenship. It's something that pervades the whole curriculum. And we were aware that in this time of subject specialism, that what can be everybody's responsibility can be nobody's responsibility. But there was a citizenship sort of network built up, and the Gordon Cook Foundation, a charitable foundation in the UK, funded lots of conferences and meetings of citizenship teachers. And of course, Curriculum for Excellence now has one of its key aims, citizenship.
103.2 Dublin City FM, Ireland's only special interest arts and cultural radio station.
You're probably best known, Pamela, in among Irish educators for your work on the review of initial teacher education, which the deliberations of your work were published in what's known as the Salberg Report. Yes. But can you say a little bit about how you went about doing your work and what that work was like?
Well, we three of us, Patsy Salberg, John Furlong and myself, were invited to take a look, as it were, from outside as to the nature of provision of initial teacher education in Ireland. And so what we did was we read a lot about what the provision was. We met with a range of university presidents and teacher education staff, and we tried to look at how research informed initial teacher education in Ireland was. The conclusion we came to, which is in the report, was that while there were pockets of very good practice and very interesting work going on, there were too many small providers, as it were, really to get the critical mass which we believed was necessary to have a really powerful research-informed teaching. Now, I know a lot of people didn't like that message, but that's, in a way, then for the system to reflect on. I mean, we have no power to implement any of that. We were asked for our views, and we gave them.
And how different did you find that initial teacher education is in Ireland compared to what you are used to in Scotland?
The curriculum content is not that different, although there are still there's still the teaching of philosophy of education and sociology of education and so on that's gone now
in
Scotland and indeed across the UK. And instead, these issues come up through the study of particular problems or issues that students encounter. So students wouldn't go for a lecture on, you know, the sociology of education or inequalities in education or something like that. The other thing that surprised us, I think, was that at that time students had to find their own schools to do teaching practice, and that's very different from the way we operate in Scotland. We think it's very important that we have a number of schools who we can assure the quality of the initial teacher education that's been provided in the schools, and that it's very important for students to experience a range of different schools. Often, I understand student teachers in Ireland will naturally enough go to their own school to seek a placement. I'm not sure that's really the best thing to do.
Because it doesn't challenge them enough?
Yes. And they're too familiar with the way things work in that school. And whether it's a very disadvantaged school or a very prosperous school, it doesn't really matter. What you initial teacher education, when you're developing as a teacher, it's just a wonderful opportunity to see a whole different variety of schools.
But I suppose you could argue that when they go in as a student teacher, they're seeing it from a very different perspective than they saw it as a student, and that may actually be of assistance to them.
Well, that depends on how well they are prepared to do that. One of the challenges I found when I was doing initial teacher education was students observe classrooms, and trying to get students to observe classrooms critically is actually quite hard, because the temptation is to become the pupil and not try and analyse what it is the teacher is doing, what the pupils are doing, how the lesson is progressing, what the big change points are, and so on and so forth. And I think it's very difficult for students to observe critically. If you're a stranger to a school, I think it's more likely. Just as when you go to a foreign country for the first time, you look around, you think, I wonder why they do things that way. In a school that you, a kind of school you've never experienced before, you're more likely to ask that question than a school that you've spent 6 years at.
Another area that is of interest to you is that of behaviour in school. Mm-hmm. How did you become interested in this topic?
Well, I worked for a time at the Scottish Council for Research and Education, and one of the issues then, I would say, bugging the teacher unions was what they contended was a deterioration in teacher behaviour. And so I said, what's the evidence for this? And we didn't have any. There's no data. Or there were little bits of data, but not very good data, and certainly no data over time. So that was my first instinct was, well, before we can really get to grips with this problem, we have to understand it a bit better. And so I managed to persuade the Scottish Government, first of all, to fund some research in behaviour in schools. And I did different kinds of research. I did research on exclusions from school, for example, where we studied schools with very similar pupil populations but very different exclusion rates to try and understand what these schools were doing that either promoted exclusion or discouraged exclusion. So that was one.
And could you say what it was?
Well, there's a lot about, again, the ethos of the school, what the school sees as its responsibilities, what the quality of the leadership is, the flexibility of the curriculum, the availability of behaviour support staff who are well trusted and respected, the bringing together of systems of guidance, pastoral care, with systems of discipline, not seeing them as two separate things, an openness to the outside world, the world outside the school, other people outside who can come in and help with pupils having long-term issues. So all those kinds of things. But a fundamental thing is, how did the teachers and the leaders of the school see their responsibility? Did they see it as an inclusive school with responsibilities for all children to get the best out of all of them? Or were they there to contain children? Were they there to kind of babysit? You know, I'm being a bit pejorative to get the point across. So those were the things that
And did that come from the principal or from the teachers?
It came from we collected data from principals, senior teachers, classroom teachers, pupils, parents. It was a big study, and so it was putting all those bits together that these issues or these themes emerged.
And finally, Pamela, you're here as a guest of the Vere Foster Trust to speak to Irish educators on taking research-informed teaching seriously from aspiration to reality. What will be the key message you want to leave behind to those who attend your talk?
The key message is, if you want to have a self-improving system, not one that, you know, people have to be forced to do things, if you want to have a self-improving system, you need reflective teachers.
And that was Pamela Munn, who is in Ireland as a guest of the Vere Foster Trust. Thanks to Pamela Munn and to the Vere Foster Trust for hosting me. Thanks too to the staff at the National Gallery, who gave us a room in which to conduct the interview. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event in a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to almost 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.